Welcome to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk. Here's your host, Jason Davis.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. Welcome into Soccer Morning right here on WorldSoccerTalk.com. Big, big day for you in the soccer world. U.S. Men's National Team Game Day, Mexico Game Day, Gold Cup semifinals tonight in Atlanta. We'll get to that momentarily. Also on this program, very excellent guest. It's been a while, but Manuel Vett, footballgrad.com, will join us. We'll talk to him about some issues coming to the fore again in Russia, and that's racism. It continues to be an issue in the Russian Premier League. The latest incidents involving Emmanuel Frimpong, Hulk, the Brazilian striker, talking about the regular racial abuse he gets playing in Russia. How will this impact anything going into 2018? We'll get Manuel's take on those issues in just a couple of minutes. In the meantime, we do have to line up our headlines this morning. Again, ahead of a U.S. men's national team game and a Mexico game and a Jamaica game and a Panama game and everything happening in the Gold Cup. Had some results from last night. We start in the U.S. Open Cup. Two results from Tuesday night, or Tuesday afternoon, in the case of the Philadelphia Union beating the New York Red Bulls on penalties at Red Bull Arena. McCarthy in goal for Philadelphia, the hero. Big stops for him in penalties, and the Union move on to the semis. Big gut shot for New York, considering that they put out a very strong lineup in that game and probably thought they would be able to win it at home. Remember, this game had a bit of controversy surrounding it in light of the scheduling issues. The Red Bulls had put a International Champions Cup friendly between PSG and Fiorentina on the schedule on Tuesday night. They played this game in the afternoon because they play Chelsea tonight at Red Bull Arena in another friendly. The other quarterfinal matchup that happened on Tuesday, Sporting Kansas City beats Houston 3-1. They were down a goal. They came back. Luis Garrido with a red card for the Dynamo, and the 10-man Dynamo could not overcome Sporting at Sporting Park. That is Sporting's ninth consecutive win at home. That is an insane record. They are unbeatable in that stadium at the moment. You have the Chicago Fire hosting Orlando City Soccer Club tonight in the last quarterfinal. The winner of that match will take on the Philadelphia Union in the semis, while RSL will take on Sporting Kansas City. Gold Cup, as I mentioned, USA-Jamaica, 6 p.m. Eastern time in Atlanta. The United States with their most difficult challenge to date in the tournament. Lots of talk out of Jurgen Klinsmann and the U.S. camp about not taking the reggae boys lightly. They absolutely should not. There's also a very excellent profile of Giles Barnes over at SI.com by Grant Wall that you should read. His winding road to MLS, to the Houston Dynamo, and to the Reggae Boys. Mexico-Panama is the second game, 9 p.m. Eastern. Giovanni Dos Santos has been ruled out of that match through injury. This is a challenge for Mexico, just as it is for the United States. If we're going to see that final that everyone expects to see, Mexico USA in Philadelphia in a couple days' time, then Mexico's got to overcome Panama as well. FIFA has told Crossfire Premier, the former club of one DeAndre Yedlin, to take their concerns to the dispute resolution chamber of FIFA. This is where FIFA adjudicates issues within the football world. This is from Leviu Bird over at SI.com. After initiating correspondence with Spurs, Crossfire alleges that MLS prevented the club from receiving its due payment and that U.S. Soccer would not intervene. FIFA has told Crossfire Premier to take its case against Major League Soccer and the U.S. Soccer Federation for solidarity payments to the governing body's dispute resolution chamber. And they suggested this in a letter to Crossfire Premier. We acknowledge receipt of your correspondence and have noted you deem that Crossfire Foundation is entitled to a portion of the solidarity contribution, FIFA said in its letter. The body competent to hear disputes relating to the solidarity mechanism between clubs belonging to different associations is the dispute resolution chamber. Part of the issue here is that there is a significant cost to go into the DRC. The usual stip cost was one major sticking point that prevented Crossfire from taking its case to the resolution chamber immediately. But the letter from FIFA states that bringing this case would cost no more than 5,000 Swiss francs or just less than $5,300 right now. The club previously believed it would be on the hook for 25,000 francs or $26,000. We'll see how this plays out. This has been an issue we have tracked here at Soccer Morning over the last couple of weeks and could have major ramifications on the structure of youth soccer in the United States, especially as it relates to pay-to-play and the like. Remember, at the heart of this issue is also the problem of pay-to-play. The fact that DeAndre Yedlin's parents likely paid significant funds to Crossfire Premier for his soccer education, and therefore it seems as though Crossfire is looking to be paid twice for the development of DeAndre Yedlin. It's an interesting story that continues to develop, and we'll keep an eye on it as FIFA has told Crossfire to go to the resolution chamber. You had a couple of those International Champions Cup ICC things last night. Barcelona beating LA Galaxy 2-1 in front of 90-something thousand people at the Rose Bowl. No Neymar, no Messi, but Barcelona obviously still of immense quality. They beat LA. You had Gerrard and Keane in the first half, and then a switch from the Galaxy. They basically turned over the whole team, put in a bunch of kids who acquitted themselves fairly well. You obviously had the Galaxy getting a goal. That came in the second half. Bradford Jameson played relatively well. You have Lassiter, who is a Galaxy player that is, I believe, the son. I need to check on this because I didn't pull it up this morning. Ariel Lassiter, right. The son of U.S. international Roy Lassiter. He is a Costa Rican player, has played for both the Costa Rican U-20s and the U.S. U-23s. He signed with the LA Galaxy 2 in December. He's 20 years old and a player to keep an eye on as he and several others of his teammates did acquitted themselves fairly well. Lots of enthusiasm, not cowed by the moment, not cowed by the stage. Interesting fallout from the FIFA corruption probe. A friendly between Brazil and Argentina planned for the United States in September has been canceled. The head of the company handling logistics for the Argentine national team told the Associated Press on Tuesday that the match has been called off as the two Argentine businessmen who own Full Play, a sports marketing company which had rights for the friendly, remain under house arrest in Argentina after being indicted in May by the U.S. Justice Department. You're going to see more of this. You're going to see more of these friendlies, which are being put together by organizations, by companies that have been pulled into the indictment, canceled, put on hold. We're clearly waiting on the fate of the 2016 Copa America tournament, Copa America Centenario set for the United States. Do not know as of yet if that will happen. We will keep an eye on that one as well, and hopefully we get some news in the coming months. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Manuel Vett from footballgrad.com about some of the issues plaguing Russia when it comes to racism. Manuel Frimpong on the end of it this time. Don't go anywhere. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com.
You're talking too loud.
This Saturday, Barcelona and Manchester United will play in front of a sold-out stadium of 68,000 fans in California. For those of you who, like me, won't be at the game, it'll be live on television. But for a different experience, I'd like to encourage you to watch the game on TV and then listen to me live on Rabble.tv at the same time. With Rabble.tv, here's how it works. After you tune into the broadcast on TV, press the mute button and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me sharing my opinions and observations. With Rabble, you can listen to my broadcast on your desktop, through your iOS app, and now through your mobile browser. So far this summer, over 3,200 of you have listened to me on Rabblecast. If you haven't checked them out yet, this Saturday would be an ideal opportunity. Plus, you can join in, too, by posting your questions and observations in the comments section. With two of the biggest clubs in the world battling it out in Santa Clara, who will get the win? Find out this Saturday, July 25th at 4 p.m. Eastern with me on Rabble.tv.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Here we are back on Soccer Morning on a Wednesday. diving into some Russian football topics with our friend Manuel Vett from footballgrad.com. He's on the line with us now. You can follow him on Twitter at Homo Sovieticus. He is there talking about these issues. Manuel, how are you this morning?
I'm all right, Jason. How about you?
I'm well. This is not good circumstances to speak with you under, but I think this deserves some further exploration. And recently, we've had some of these racial abuse incidents in Russian football that seem to happen entirely too often. And more importantly than the incidents themselves is the reaction. First, outline exactly what happened with former Arsenal player Emmanuel Frimpong, who's now at Ufa, I believe.
Yeah, he plays with FK Ufa. This was a game, first day of the season in the Russian Premier League. So he was racially abused by a set of Spartak fans from the stands and reacted by both swearing at the fans and showing them the middle finger. And then was sent off as a result of that, was sent off by the referee. Of course, at first you didn't quite understand why he was reacting that way, but all of that came out later. So, quite sad. First day of the Russian Premier League season, and we right away have the first case of racism in the league once again.
Now, I don't know exactly the timing, but this incident comes right around the same time that Hulk, the Brazilian striker of Zenit St. Petersburg, has made some public comments that this happens all the time. He says almost every game he faces racial abuse. Is there any response at all within Russia and specifically Russian football over these incidents?
I think, you know, what you sort of see now is that they're starting to have the Russian football is starting to have a response. I mean, this has been going on for years. I've been recently to Russia to speak about this issue at a conference organized by the FAIR Network, and some of the numbers that were brought up at this conference were just staggering. Last season, halfway through last season, they had 99 incidents of racism. So this is pretty much every game or every week, isn't it? So it keeps coming up and keeps coming up. And last season, I think because of some of the reports that were emerging and because Russia is coming closer to hosting the World Cup, what you sort of see now is that the Russian Football Union is at least responding to these problem cases, that they're at least starting to punish fans and clubs. And the newest thing that you see is that a lot of fans are speaking out. You know, the average fan goer, the ones that are not ultras, that they are saying, well, we don't really want to have this in the stadium. The one thing that I'm, of course, wondering is this due to society really realizing that they're having a major problem, or if that is just the case because, you know, the World Cup is coming around and they're worried that this might have an effect on how FIFA will treat these incidents. So, but at least, you know, there's dialogue now starting, but it's just sad that every game something is really happening.
Certainly, and it needs to be addressed. Is the cynical view that this is a results-based sort of response that, hey, we have to be careful here, we have to fix our problem, or we need to address our problem because of the World Cup in 2018, because of what FIFA may do to us, does that matter to you right now, or is any progress good at this point?
Yeah, it's difficult, right? Because I think a huge part of it is because of the World Cup. And I mean, on the one hand, yes, any kind of progress is good. The fact that people are acknowledging, hey, wait, well, there is something wrong with us. There is something wrong in how we treat foreigners playing in our league, playing football to entertain us, really. And, you know, so there is that the awareness is starting, at least that's a good thing. I'm just sort of wondering sometimes if it's for the wrong reason. And what comes on top of that is this sense that a lot of it is that they themselves feel victimized by Western media, sort of saying, well, look at the bad Russians and look at how racist they all are, and sort of trying to deviate some of the blame and trying to, like, sort of state that it's been put out of proportion, that it isn't as bad as it is. So you have, on the one hand, the acknowledgement. On the other hand, you have this automatic reflex to say, well, it isn't that bad, and it's we only being criticized because we are hosting the World Cup. So it's kind of, I think it's great that they're acknowledging it for somewhat, but I wonder sometimes if it is for the wrong reasons.
There's a lot of things at play here. A lot of elements of the way Russia relates to the rest of the world, certainly to the West. And I guess what I need to know from you, Manuel, is whether or not Russia's society is dealing with these issues head on, or if this is only viewed through the prism of football. And I guess some of that relates to how homogeneous Russian society is right now, and whether or not that element can be, you know, separated, divided from the rest of general Russian culture.
Yeah, it's difficult because there's so many elements at play in Russian culture, right? And it's a very multicultural society, because of its Soviet legacy. It's also a society that differs from the way people are in the big cities, Moscow, St. Petersburg, etc., and how the rural society is. It's in that sense very similar to the United States, you know, where you find a very open, liberal-minded society in the big cities, and then when you go in some of the rural areas, it's very close-minded, and people would never even dare to address some of these issues. And I find it very difficult to judge if Russian people in general really realize what is at stake here, and what it means for some of these players coming to Russia, playing there, and being racially abused every game. I think that this kind of awareness isn't just there yet.
It brings again the question of why black players would choose to go play in Russia. I mean, a paycheck is a paycheck, Manuel, and I know some of these clubs are paying very well, but, you know, Emmanuel Frimpong, maybe he didn't know what he was getting into. I mean, certainly his experience is going to get a lot of notoriety now, just based on this being the first game of the season, him being sent off, the reaction from the club, which I'll get to in a minute. What is the general consensus? Is it just about an opportunity to play at a fairly high level, or is there something else here?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate in May. I was able to speak to Yaya Toure, who played, of course, at Metalurg Donetsk in Ukraine, where they have very similar issues. And he said that, you know, 90% of the people treated him very, very well. He was welcomed with open arms, and you know, he was given the opportunity to play European football. He was given the opportunity to prove himself at a relatively high level. And he said that, well, you know, the people were nice and warm and welcoming, but it's, you know, it's enough that 10% of the people, if 10% of the people react this way, and react this way quite openly and in a very aggressive manner, that of course is very hurtful. I think that players are going there because they feel that it's a high level where they can prove themselves. And for a lot of players, this is the first time that they get to play in European football. And when you play at a club, let's say SKA Moscow or Zenit St. Petersburg, clubs that are regularly featured in Champions League football, it's sort of a very good way to present yourself to the larger European market. So I think that's why players are going there. And also I think that one has to remember that a large percentage of people in Russia will actually welcome these players with open arms. But then there's also this really frightening part of the society that is very aggressive and very, very racist, which is kind of makes it, I think, in some points very difficult for these guys to play there.
You know, I'm looking at some tweets. Soccer Morning, we're retweeting some things here. It looks like Frimpong has been handed a 2-match suspension for his reaction to this racism. Now, You know, there seems to be a disconnect here, Manuel. Obviously, there are some people who are understanding that this needs to be addressed, that this can't happen. Even if, again, if it's a cynical reason for it, they at least acknowledge that they can't have fans, ultras, abusing black players on the field because of how it portrays Russian football. And then Russian football goes and hands a player who was racially abused and has an emotional reaction. Now, again, should Emmanuel Frimpong do what he did? I mean, I think that's up for debate. He clearly can't within the laws of the game. But to give him an additional suspension is another bad look for Russian football.
Yeah, you know, it's so difficult. What is the right way to react? I remember in Italian football, they had the similar issues where a few players walked off and they were suspended afterwards. It's such a hard line, right? On the one hand, you have to honor the laws of the game, which clearly state one that players should not react to any fan abuse. If that is the proper way of handling it, I find that very doubtful. I'm actually more curious to see what kind of punishment Spartak will be handed in the last few years. The last year, the RFU has been very tough on clubs and handing several clubs tough suspensions, empty playing and empty stadiums, etc. But yes, of course, handing Emmanuel Frimpong another two matches is a bit of a slap in the face, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, this is from, I'm going to butcher his name and I apologize, Toki Müller Tilade, Russian football news editor. He says that Frimpong has been handed a two-match suspension and Spartak has received a fine of 323 euros for throwing objects on the field.
Well, yeah, that doesn't seem right. I think if what Emmanuel Frimpong said is correct, then Spartak should be punished a lot harsher. I don't think this is going to be the end of it yet, because in the past we have seen that clubs were given a light punishment at first, and then because of media pressure and pressure from the West, the punishments.
Well, again, that's the cynical reaction. Oh, we have to do it now. Now, again, I talk about the disconnect between what, and I'm referring to a piece over at footballgrad.com, which everybody should go and read as soon as we're done talking to Manuel. It's a commentary on the Frimpong incident from Manuel and Saul Pope. And you have, Saul has some quotes or some comments here translated from the Russian, from fans on the story on the websites where this was obviously written up for the press. And, you know, it's a lot of, we need to fix this. This is a problem. Spartak fans are terrible, et cetera, et cetera. It's sort of the right tone that you want to hear. Again, even if it's about 2018 and sanctions, at least it's going in that direction. And the disconnect happens when the Russian football authorities get involved. And I'm not even just including, the league bosses or the Russian FA. I'm talking about club management. In this case, Emmanuel Frimpong's club is Shamil Gazizov. It was an unfortunate incident. There were people who could have shouted things. These are emotions which go away after the game. We are partners with Spartak and are on good terms. And what Frimpong did was wrong. Sometimes you have to hold back the tears and just put up with it. That's the wrong way to handle this, Manuel.
Yeah, I agree, and it is absolutely the wrong way. But you know, the club bosses, they are like a fraternity, aren't they? And they're gonna stick together no matter what. And the first reaction, and it's quite typical, is to protect yourself and not the players, which is absolutely wrong. And the way the Russian Football Union has been handling this, I shouldn't be too surprised, because we tried to organize this conference together with them in May, and all we got was red tape. So, you know, it's not hugely surprising that this is playing out the way it is. But, I mean, on the other hand, well, it's not really on the other hand. It's just really unfortunate the way it plays out.
Yeah, my friend, one of our listeners, Washington in New York, is asking about specific rules or laws within the Russian game to address racist behavior on the part of fans. Is there anything specific, or are they only subject to the same laws and rules that all of UEFA is subject to?
They're subject to the same laws and rules that UEFA rules, yeah. So that's basically, they have whole pamphlets and everything stating that they don't want to see any of this behavior. I mean, saying that is one thing. Acting on it is a complete different matter, isn't it? So, yeah, they are subject to these rules. And I've seen in the past that UEFA then actually went out and punished these clubs subsequently. So, as I said, I don't think we've seen the end of this at all yet.
Yeah, I can imagine that UEFA will have something to say about this. But again, now we come to the crux of the matter for a lot of these Russian fans, and it's the issues of these incidents as they may relate to 2018. And for me, Manuel, it's not just about what happens on the field in 2018, although certainly that's going to be the most highly publicized situation. It's also about fans traveling to Russia. It's about the welcoming nature of the Russian people when the world gathers for a World Cup. Now, we saw at the Olympics, there were no issues as far as I am aware, beyond budgetary issues. Is there a reason to be fearful? I mean, if we're talking about African Americans or African fans themselves from Nigeria and Ghana, is there any concern for them traveling to Russia in 2018?
I can understand if you were wary to go to Russia 2018. I would totally understand it. But at the same time, I believe that Russia will show itself from the best side. They will do whatever it takes to make sure that nothing will happen. So I think it will be safe to go. But that's, of course, despite the point, isn't it? Because these issues are going on now. And the thing is to fix it, not just so people can go safely to the World Cup, but also to just make sure that these things don't happen anymore, period. That Russian society really is able to clean its act up, not just to show a good face to the West, but just to actually improve as a society in general. And I think that is really the most important aspect.
Well, we know that's not going to happen in 3 years' time. So, you know, I guess what we need to see, or what the rest of the world will be looking to see here, is, again, not just addressing the issues on the field, although that's step one, and let's be a little bit more heavy-handed with our punishments when it comes to these things, but also some progress in that direction. You know, we understand that Sepp Blatter's notion of FIFA is that it can be a positive force of change in the world, and I guess what we come to then is whether or not this tournament can be a positive force for change in Russia as it relates to this racial abuse and sort of the some of the hate that comes out of certain segments of Russian society.
Well, I hope it's gonna, you know, even if it's for the wrong reason, just to basically prove to the rest of the world that they have a friendly, open society, even if it's just for that, if that is all the World Cup legacy is, then that is a huge step forward. But as you said, it's in 3 years' time, and to clean up something that is so ingrained in 3 years, it seems almost impossible. So I think what is going to happen is that there will be this really positive face that we'll see from the Russian people. And as I said before, 90% of Russian people are completely open, warm, friendly people that do not feel the same way than a lot of these ultras, racist ultras feel that go to stadiums. But of course, 10% is enough, right? And these 10% are so vocal and so aggressive that they make it difficult for people of color, black people, to go to games right now. And that is something that that needs to be addressed quite heavily. So if the World Cup's legacy is just that, that's fantastic, but I just don't think in 3 years is going to be enough time to address this issue.
Let's turn to the preparations for 2018 in a more general sense, Manuel. There's obviously there's been some hand wringing over Russia's getting this tournament. If there's a positive result out of it, then I suppose we can all look back and say, yeah, that was fine. Certainly a lot more focus on Qatar and some of the issues there, and some of those issues are of more importance than what's going on in Russia. But we have the specter of racism hanging over Russia, and the specter of the budget and how much money is actually being spent on preparations. I guess stadiums matter more than anything else, but I have heard that the plans for hotels and lodging have been scaled way back, and that fans might be asked to camp out for this tournament.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting to follow because the ruble crisis, of course, has made it a bit more difficult for Russia to budget this tournament. And, you know, the reaction was they scaled back a couple of stadiums, which FIFA supported, but they also scaled back the budget, which means that, of course, they're going to not do some investments into infrastructure, especially in some of the smaller cities. I think when you go to Moscow or St. Petersburg, it should be fine. It's not going to be great because Russia is not exactly the prime tourism destination. But I think when you go to the big cities, it should be okay. But yeah, I think it could be really interesting for people traveling to Russia and trying to find accommodation and trying to find places to stay.
You know, it's one of the issues in Brazil was transportation, was that country's air travel infrastructure. What's obviously Russia's a big country. I don't know how spread out the sites are. I imagine there's some significant distances here. I know train travel is a major factor here, but what's the outlook for the amount of airline traffic that Russia's likely to get in 2018?
I think it's exactly going to be like Brazil, because even though the tournament is taking place mostly in the western part of the country, the western part of Russia is still enormous. Mm-hmm. And so people will be, I think there will be a lot of flying. I think that's going to be okay because they're not obviously going to use some of the airlines that they use for normal day-to-day traffic in Russia. And that there's going to be a huge reliance on trains. So there is a couple high-speed train lines that are now put in to connect some of the host cities. But they had planned to connect them all with high-speed train lines. And I don't think that's going to happen now. That's definitely off the table.
You know, so much of the way that the West views Russia is based on the actions of Vladimir Putin. He is a large figure in all of this. Is there a sense that this tournament is part of does it flow from Putin? Is it more extolling his personal virtues as much as it is sort of, hey, here's Russia and we're ready to host the world?
Putin is he played a major part in getting the tournament in the first place. I think that's a very difficult question. I think on one hand, of course, this is going to be another Putin show, just as it was at the Olympics. But on the other hand, I think that the tournament was rife to go to Russia. They are the largest European country to never have hosted that tournament, a big tournament, period. So I think in that sense, it's not like Qatar where you think, well, we're giving the tournament to a country that has 300,000 people. We're giving this tournament went to a country that has a long tradition. The tournament in Russia has a long tradition of football, a very long tradition of football. And, you know, it was very much overdue to receive a tournament like this. But of course, you run into the danger to make this tournament a Putin show. That's definitely an aspect that's going to be interesting to watch.
Finally, let's in terms of the general health of the Russian Premier League, they instituted that schedule switch. They changed their seasons partly because of the World Cup, or maybe entirely because of the World Cup, if I remember correctly. There's clearly, you mentioned the crash of the ruble having an impact on preparations for the 2018 World Cup. How has that impacted the league, and how has it impacted the bigger clubs? And certainly, what is the outlook for the Russian Premier League within the greater environment of UEFA in the future?
Well, what I think is interesting is that a lot of the very big clubs, the big clubs like Spartak, Zenit, CSKA, Lokomotiv, they were impacted by the ruble crisis, not because that meant financial difficulties for them, but because it actually meant that they were no longer able to justify their large budgets towards financial fair play. So that meant that some of these clubs had to scale back a bit. And Dynamo Moscow, for example, they were punished by UEFA, banned from playing in the Europa League not because they had a large debt, but because the UEFA didn't quite understand how they could have such a large budget and how it flowed into the club. It was quite, there was a huge transparency issue here. about the league switching over, I think large part of that wasn't just for the World Cup. It was also so that Russian clubs could be more competitive playing in Champions League and Europa League.
Right.
Which is, of course, it didn't really help that much because they still have this massive winter break because it's just too cold to play in Russia after November. It's just impossible. And really, it's also impossible to play in Russia before February. Even February is very tough, so you can't really play until March. So you still have that long winter break. But the idea was that to make clubs more competitive in European football. And I think they still suffer, not because it's not a competitive league, because it's a highly competitive league. It's a fantastic league to watch. If you just want to watch good football, it's a great, great place to watch. But it's because the winter break is really kind of making it very tough for clubs to compete, you know, in that first round of the Champions League, the first round of the Europa League that is quite early on in February usually.
All right, last thing here, a question from our friend Mark on Twitter. He wants to know how closely the media is following the FIFA scandal. I know that there have been some statements, I believe from Putin himself, outlining that the United States has overstepped their bounds. So clearly there's an antagonistic response to all of this.
I thought the response by Russia was so interesting on the FIFA scandal, because I personally didn't think that it was ever in doubt that Russia would keep this tournament. But yet, the way Putin and the way the politicians in Russia reacted was such a symbol for Russia today, because the reaction right away was, of course, oh, it's the West coming out to get us and trying to take the tournament away from us, and completely overreacted. Almost in fear, thinking that this is going to be, the tournament is going to be gone, and hanging on to Blatter as much as they could. I thought it was really interesting watching this, because in my mind, I don't think Russia 2018 is going to be put in doubt simply because it's too close to kick off. So I don't think they really had anything to worry about. But the fact that they reacted this way was just fascinating, because it was the same reaction that they would show to any kind of other political matter, any kind of other criticism towards Russia. So it was kind of like a mirror to what's going on in geopolitics in general.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think there's any chance Russia loses this tournament, and that's interesting in light of the racism issues and certainly the fan response. So there's got to be there's some paranoia on the part of Russian football in general, and that's we'll see how that ends up playing out. I'm running out of time. Manuel Vett from footballgrad.com. Make sure you follow him on Twitter. It's Homo Sovieticus. He's a fantastic follow for things Russian football. And obviously, as we get closer to 2018, he's a must follow. Thank you very much for your time, Manuel. I appreciate it. It was fantastic.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines and talk to you on a Wednesday. USA Jamaica tonight. What do you make of that? Don't go anywhere. Soccer Morning, worldsoccertalk.com. This Saturday, Barcelona and Manchester United will play in front of a sold-out stadium of 68,000 fans in California. For those of you who, like me, won't be at the game, it'll be live on television. But for a different experience, I'd like to encourage you to watch the game on TV and then listen to me live on Rabble.tv at the same time. With Rabble.tv, here's how it works. After you tune into the broadcast on TV, press the mute button and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me sharing my opinions and observations. With Rabble, you can listen to my broadcast on your desktop, through your iOS app, and now through your mobile browser. So far this summer, over 3,200 of you have listened to me on Rabblecast. And if you haven't checked them out yet, this Saturday would be an ideal opportunity. Plus, you can join in, too, by posting your questions and observations in the comments section. With two of the biggest clubs in the world battling it out in Santa Clara, who will get the win? Find out this Saturday, July 25th at 4 p.m. Eastern with me on Rabble.tv.
Back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Here we are back on Soccer Morning on a Wednesday. Game day, United States men's national team, Jamaica, How excited are you? I almost put on my Bomb Pop shirt today, and I chose not to, and I don't know why, and I hope I don't jinx the national team. I should have probably worn it. Instead, I wore my Baller Blazer shirt, which, while it's a fantastic shirt, and you should go get one at backheel.com/store, doesn't actually represent the United States in a positive way, because, as we know, Mr. Blazer was operating alongside U.S. soccer for a very long time, doing his dirty deeds, and nobody called him on it. And, yeah. By the way, if we have to take up that mantle, hell yes, I'll do that. Now, they dragged Dan Flynn in front of a Senate subcommittee. They asked for Sino Galati to show up, and he didn't. And we called out U.S. soccer on those issues on this show. I don't want it to go away. It can't go away. Chuck Blazer, again, was doing his thing in the United States for 25 years. And nobody stood up and said, hey, wait a second. That guy's doing some stuff. No, they said, we can't mess with the system. Got to work within the system, even if the system is Chuck and Jack and everybody doing their dirty. By the way, did you see this? Did you see what Jeffrey Webb used as Bond? Trevor, did you see this story? This is amazing. Jeffrey Webb, in order to secure his $10 million bond after he was extradited from Switzerland to the United States, he used a 2015 Ferrari, a 2014 Range Rover, a 2003 Mercedes-Benz, a $401,000 account in his wife's name, his wife's diamond wedding ring, a 401k his wife holds, 11 watches, 11 luxury watches. Now, where did Jeffrey Webb, the president of the Cayman Islands Football Association, and subsequently CONCACAF president, because we know how the Caribbean does when it comes to voting in their people, where did he get 11 Hublot watches? Hublot? How do you say that? I always read it. I've never actually said it. Because I've never had one. Oh, Cartier Roadster, Breitling, Royal Oak Offshore, Luminor Marina. These sound like expensive things. 5 Rolexes. I know how that works. Where the hell did he get all this? Oh, wait a second. I know where he got it. You know where he got it. The world knows where he got it. And like I said, whether they did anything wrong or not, directly themselves, U.S. soccer was party to all of it by standing there and letting it happen. Good Lord. Anyway, I really didn't intend to go in that direction. Take your phone calls, 646-832-3909. What do you expect from the United States tonight against Jamaica? What are you afraid of? What do you think the United States needs to do to win this game, make the Gold Cup final, and have a chance to win back-to-back tournaments? Are you worried at all? What kind of lineup do you want to see from the United States and Jurgen Klinsmann? Because they crushed Cuba. Cuba is not a measuring stick of anything. Excuse me. Beating Cuba 6-0 means very little as it relates to beating a quality team like Jamaica. Now, at least they didn't have to go 120 minutes like Mexico did. Now, Panama did too, so that game could be pretty slow in Atlanta. I know they're playing indoors, but travel apparently a big problem. Travel for both Panama and Mexico. Both of those teams very upset about travel. Very, very upset about the travel. Damn, travel. Let's go back just quickly. The issues of the racism in Russian football. The continuing efforts to address those issues. Make sure you read, seriously, the piece by Saul Pope and Manuel Vett at footballgrad.com. FUTBOLGRAD.com. That's the Russian football website that they run. It's a fantastic website. Gives you insight into what's going on here. Manuel talks about that event that he hosted in Russia on these issues with the FAIR Network in Moscow. There is those translated comments I mentioned from various websites after the Frimpong incident. And I also would highly suggest you go read Maridi Marungi at Fusion.net, the Soccer Gods website, the soccer world continues to condone Russia's racism, which he posted yesterday. Because this is not going to go away. And what we need to do as a soccer viewing public is make sure it doesn't go away. Yes, sure, we should talk about Qatar. We should talk about those continuing issues of the labor force there and the fact that it's 120 degrees in the summer and the fact that, you know, they're creating a city out of nothing to host the World Cup and they're spending all this money on stadiums. They have 300,000 people in the entire country and you can't drink there and all of those things. Mainly the labor stuff. Mainly the indentured servitude. Mainly the kafala system. People dying. Maybe that. But at the same time, we should not forget about the issues in Russia. They may not be directly about people dying, but they absolutely are egregious and need to be talked about. The more pressure that's placed on Russia, the more likely they are to respond with some actual steps. And again, this morning, word is Emmanuel Frimpong has been given a 2-game suspension, and the Spartak fans, or the Spartak, the club, has been fined roughly 300 euros for their fans throwing stuff on the field. No mention of racism at all in the statement about their punishment. Tell me that's not a ridiculous set of circumstances. 646-832-3909 is your phone number. Jump in here. Talk to me about the U.S. men's national team. Talk to me about what you see out of Jamaica tonight. Talk to me about Mexico. Talk to me about how you think Mexico will do against a better squad in Panama. Maybe not better than Costa Rica on paper, but certainly they've played better in this tournament. They've been more competitive in this tournament. They will give Mexico a challenge. I think all of the talking before the match means very little. Giovanni Dos Santos ruled out, by the way. Although you wonder if that's really an issue for Mexico, the way that they've been playing. Could he really make a difference? He's a bit of a luxury player at this point, almost. Meanwhile, by the way, his brother has been really, really good in the middle of midfield. As for the United States, Clint Dempsey leading the charge, he is the guy pulling them along. I imagine Aaron Johansson is the starter alongside him. They played well enough against Cuba that should be your striker pairing, if only because you haven't seen a lot of out of anybody else. I expect Giassi's artist to start in midfield, because if you have two strikers already outlined, and again, I guess you could move Dempsey around. Move him and drop him into midfield and start Giassi's artist alongside Aaron Johansson, and now you've got Dempsey in the hole, but now you've got to cover that space and you got to create some defensive stability. Can you play Bradley and Beckerman in a game where you have Dempsey in the hole? 4-2-3, nope, can't do that. You got to play a 4-man back line. You don't want to get overrun in midfield. You certainly don't want Jamaica to be able to bypass your midfield quickly. You're going to have to clog some of those lanes. You're going to have to get people in the way of Jamaica. Ray Orozco on Twitter's got the United States winning 3-1, big game from Dempsey and Bradley. Those are the two guys you want to step up. Those are the two guys you need to see step up. Clint Dempsey's done that. He's leading the tournament in goals. Now, I know Cuba. Three of them came against Cuba, but he's leading the tournament in goals. He's playing well. Michael Bradley, just a little bit up and down, but solid. This is what I think you desperately need in a game that matters against a quality opponent, game you have to win. Clint Dempsey up top. Michael Bradley in the midfield, preferably not in the hole, playing a little bit deeper. Kyle Beckerman behind him. We know they're going to start, Klinsmann will start Brad Guzan in goal. Beyond that, what else do you want to see? I think Alejandro Bedoya gives you the best chance to win. I don't know if Giassi Zardes is defensively strong enough, but he's got the speed to keep up with the Jamaicans up and down the flank. You play Fabian Johnson behind him, or I suppose, now that you got DeMarcus Beasley, you play DeMarcus Beasley behind him. There's plenty of quicks there left in DeMarcus's legs. Then you on the other side, there you put Fabian Johnson at right back. Soar up that side of the field. Bedoya and Johnson together on the right side actually sounds pretty damn good to me. Now, what do you play in the middle? You're going to go with Omar Gonzalez, not the fleetest of foot, but can win everything in the air. How much do you expect Jamaica to actually play the ball in the air? Are you going to go with the youngsters, Ventura Alvarado, who has been extremely shaky throughout this tournament? And obviously you got John Brooks. Do you expect Klinsmann to go with Alvarado and Brooks? And how much does that scare you? Nobody's got any thought. You guys are all just locked up, fearful of this match right now. 646-832-3909. Or maybe you're taking in all of that serious, important information we just got out of Manuel Vett, which was fantastic stuff, by the way. He's great on the air. He's great on this show. And we'll continue to watch that story. A Gold Cup final, Mexico, United States, and Philadelphia, is what we all sort of expected. I mean, you could have thrown in a wrinkle or two, but I think most people would have said it'll be the USA and Mexico in the final on July 26th in Philadelphia. It's just a matter of how we get there. And I was reading this morning a piece over at ESPN FC in which Jeff Carlisle, noted American soccer writer, and our friend Tom Marshall, Mexico World Cup on Twitter, sort of They took stock of their respective beats at this point. Carlisle looked into the United States and considered where they are, while Tom Marshall looked at Mexico. And the bottom line is, are they good enough to win right now? Can you see them winning this tournament? And to be honest with you, both of them have serious questions. And I think tonight will tell us something about who the favorite's going to be, clearly. You have to enjoy Jamaica coach Winfried Schaefer pulling out the underdog card. I mean, the hardcore underdog card. Saying that this is David versus Goliath. It feels like David versus Goliath. That's fine with us. We'll try to hit the giant where it hurts most. Is it really that big of a gap? I mean, look, I don't think anybody thinks Jamaica's on the U.S. level, generally speaking, but in this tournament, the way things have gone, I don't know. Jamaican forward Michael Seaton, a D.C. United player, we're feeling good on and off the pitch, and that brings a confidence to our team. And then Michael Bradley said, we know Jamaica well. They have a unique blend of organization and discipline and also athleticism. So the United States doesn't sound like they're taking Jamaica for granted, that they're just going to walk this game. But let me tell you something. The way that they've come out in this tournament, aside from the Cuba match, they can't afford to be going down a goal in the first 15, 20 minutes. They have to come out with the higher intensity level. Because that's one of the criticisms. Whatever you make of Klinsmann and his tactics and where he's pushing this program, one thing you can certainly criticize him for is the lack of intensity out of his team when that first whistle blows. That hasn't been very good. Not in the group stage. Cuba was a pushover. Cuba we throw out. So considering that, you need to see something better out of them in the first 15 or 20 minutes. You need to see them with their foot on the gas. Now, that doesn't mean that we'll want them to bunker if they score and sit back and wait for Jamaica to try to break them down, even if that's a reasonable tactic. What you need to see is a goal in the first 15 or 20, and the United States continue to push. Put pressure on Jamaica, put pressure on the ball, make them play slower, make them play sideways, for lack of a better way of saying it. Albert in L.A., you're on the air. Hello, Albert. No?
Hello, Jason?
Yes, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, this is Robert from L.A., not Albert.
Trevor's typing too fast. Robert, yes, of course it is. Hi, Robert.
Okay, hey, Jason. Real fast about the Jamaica, U.S. This, I don't think this is a David versus Goliath because this is a team that beat us in, 2 years ago in World Cup qualification. So it's going to be a very, very... I want to say one. It's going to be very evenly matched and very hard to win, but I believe the U.S. will win.
Okay. I think that look again. Don't underestimate Jamaica. Man for man, the United States is a better team. They should have maybe not a home field advantage, certainly in Atlanta necessarily, but they should be more comfortable in those environments. I don't know. By the way, this is the first time that U.S. has played in Atlanta since 1977. That's pretty amazing. What's the scoreline, Robert?
I see 2-1.
All right, 2-1 United States. You know, don't think they can keep a clean sheet, but perhaps they get two on the other end. Dempsey and Zardes to score, right? That sounds good, right?
Yeah, I like Zardes. Okay. Keep my boy up there.
By the way, what'd you make of that game last night? Because especially the second half, which was way more interesting.
Well, yeah, but as you can see, when you make like wholesale changes in the second half, both teams make it, it's going to be a very, very different flow of the game.
Of course. But 92,000 out to see that game. Clearly, Barcelona's the draw. But, you know, you put those kids, Ariel Lassiter, Bradford Jameson IV, some of those other kids. I'm forgetting the other forward you guys have that you've been using recently, who started the game, actually. Maybe in midfield. You know, when you put them out there and you say, here's a giant crowd who's there for Barcelona, you're playing against some of the best players in the world, you're playing against one of the best clubs in the world, I thought they showed a lack of fear that was encouraging. And honestly, the sense I got, Robert, when I went to bed last night, the thing I was thinking about is LA is spending money on Gerard, Dos Santos, they've got Keane, they've got Zardes locked up, they've got Omar Gonzalez, they've got this talent level. And they've got these kids coming through. I mean, what? I don't know who's going to be able to compete with LA. They're not going to win every title. But over the next 10 years, I could see them winning 4 or 5.
Yeah, they'll be up there in every year with, like, every tournament, especially with, Sports Shield Cup, hopefully in Champions League. Hopefully. About that. Also, it was way better than last year's 8-0. Robbing from Manchester United.
Yeah.
So,
all right, Rob.
I mean, there's that.
Yeah. I got to run, man. Appreciate the call. There goes Robert in LA. Little delay on his end. Apologize for that. Eddie in Brooklyn. What's up, man?
Hey, what's up? So this whole David Goliath thing, can't let you guys get away with this. It is 100% David versus Goliath.
All right. Calm down.
as long as this Gold Cup continues to be the shambolic tournament that it has always been, it will always be David versus Goliath. You're playing USA or Mexico.
Okay.
Period.
Shambolic tournament. It certainly has its issues. This tournament, we know it does. There's no doubt about that. And yeah, the damn thing is lined up for USA or Mexico to win it pretty much every year and every 2 years. And you consider that, hey, you know, Mexico's going to get calls like they got. Now, I haven't had you on the show since that happened. What was Eddie in Brooklyn's house like? Let me remember correctly. Your wife is Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So yeah, what was your house like when Arriba Peralta goes down under the Roy Miller, whatever that was?
See, my wife is smart. She saw how I was all the entire game and how my father was the entire game and even my son who is rooting for Costa Rica. And when that happened, she knew, you know what? Don't celebrate this. Just don't, because she knew how wrong it was. She said she didn't want to accept it because we had our own bets and we just called it a draw because it was just absolute robbery. And, you know, she's smarter than that.
You know, I wonder though, like, are you the type? There have been times, I mean, if that happened to my team, and certainly the United States has had their fair share of rough calls, I can get angry. I mean, when I was 21, 22, I let that simmer for days. I imagine that's not you now, especially with the family and the wife, but it's gotta make you mad. Like, you gotta have gone to bed or angry that night.
No, actually, surprisingly, my friends were angry for me, like my American friends. They were angry for, I let it go after the final whistle, because I just looked at my father, and everybody who knows me, everybody who follows me knows how I feel about Gold Cup and how I've always maintained that it's nothing more than CONCACAF's biannual attempt to ensure that either Mexico or the U.S. go to the Confederations Cup. I've always maintained that. Okay. And I kind of felt like that validated everything I ever said about this. Like, again, I called it a shambolic tournament for a reason. So I looked at my dad. I said, are you surprised? Did you expect anything else? It wasn't disgraceful. It wasn't robbery, really. It was inevitable Gold Cup.
Yeah, ultimately it was par for the course, right?
Basically.
It's rough. What else you got to share today, Eddie?
Not much. The ironic part is that I have to analyze the rest of this damn tournament, and I have to analyze U.S. and Mexico specifically, so it's kind of like my manager's just rubbing it in on me a little bit, but that's what it is, what it is, man. I just want to see if, against all odds, Mexico and the U.S. can make the final. The magic of the Gold Cup.
Such good sarcasm. Eddie, appreciate the call, man.
I'm out.
There you go. All right, 646-832-3909. Last call for phone calls. It's been a weird morning. Trevor's had some interesting things happen on the line. We'll see exactly what happens tonight in the Gold Cup semifinals. It's the United States and Costa Rica. I'm sorry, it's the United States and Mexico going to try to get into the final again. As Eddie said, maybe the whole thing's set up to do that. It certainly seems that way sometimes. The referees are on their side. The fans are on their side for the most part. The travel is none too kind to smaller nations. I guess it is David and Goliath. I guess it is. Jamaica is David. They're going to be trying to sling that rock, and it's up to the United States not to let it hit him in the forehead, knock him down, or wherever that rock hit him, wherever that thing hit him. All right. Things have slowed down here. Excellent show. Thank you very much to Manuel Vett. Go read his stuff at footballgrad.com. Not just the stuff about racism in Russia, also the stuff about Russian football in general. There's some very good insight over there on the growth of that league, the continuing development of that league. They are under under pressure because of the dropping ruble. Vladimir Putin obviously is a major figure in this World Cup saga, so the work done at footballgrad.com will give you some insight into all of these various issues. I'm just checking out Twitter here. Apparently, I'm being called the Paul Feinbaum of soccer, which is a very scary thing. Indeed, I don't think I am. I hope I never become that. But, you know, these things happen. All right. Thank you very much for listening, guys. Go to backheel.com/store to buy yourself a Soccer Morning mug. They're lovely. I've got one right here, as a matter of fact. It's quite the thing, and you can go to backheel.com/store to buy a t-shirt. This one is real cool. It's the Baller Blazer t-shirt. And that's it. I think we're out on a Wednesday. Go USA. I guess go Mexico, because that'll be the most fun final. And yeah, we'll see you tomorrow. Deal with the aftermath then. Later.
Tell me why the hell no one is here. Tell me what to do to make it all fair.